Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled George and Georgette, Regency Madness and Inspiration. The Regency period lasted a mere 9 years, while Prince Regent George ruled as his temporary mad father's proxy. The glamour and charm of the era has lasted far longer, with a plethora of novels set in those times, first made popular by Georgette Heyer in the 1920s. Alison Goodman, Anne Gracie, and Anna Campbell chat with Elizabeth Jane Corbett about their inspirational sources, their own passion for the period, and how they have played with the tradition of Regency romance.
I've had a lovely time researching for this panel, dipping back into Jane Austen, indulging in Georgette Heyer, and of course reading multiple books by our panellists. Three very different authors who each set their works in Regency Britain. Anne Gracie, whose novels delightfully interlink romance with strong sisterly relationships. Anna Campbell, whose passionate Regency romances include all the physical intimacies that Heyer left out. And Alison Goodman, whose Regency Supernatural series featuring Lady Helen and the Dark Days Club is so full of erst, I couldn't put them down on the four occasions on which I've read them. The first book to arrive in my pre-panel reading pile was Anna Campbell's The Highlander's Lost Lady, and I must confess it put me into a bit of a spin. You see, it had a man on the cover, with his shirt half undone, revealing a rather delightful set of pecs. And that wasn't the cause of my consternation, however. No, that came from the bottom of the image. You see, the man was wearing a kilt, and I thought, oh dear, this is a mistake. Not that I've got anything against kilts either. But I used to be a public librarian, and at one point my task was to select books for housebound residents. And I can tell you for absolute certain that if I'd sent The Highlander's Lost Lady to Mrs. Smith from Sunset Rest Manor, who was an avid reader of Regency romance, I would have received a crisp letter in reply. Dear Elizabeth, I enjoyed Arabella, simply scandalous, and Suddenly You, all excellent Regency romances. However, as discussed at our initial interview, I don't read Highland romance. Okay, I'd have thought looking down at the letter, better put a note on that file. While in my head, I would have been working out how to inform Mrs. Smith that she had made a mistake. So I thought we would make that our first question and that we would give Anna right of reply to Mrs. Smith.
How? Oh, Mrs. Smith, grow a pair.
No kilts.
How do you define Regency romance or the Regency?
I find this really interesting. One of the things is, as Liz said, the Regency officially is a very short period. It's 1811 to 1820 when George III's madness had reached a stage that his son had to become like the pro forma ruler of England. However, in historical romance terms, as I'm sure you all know, the Regency basically goes from the French Revolution up to the accession of Victoria. So my stuff is actually reign of George IV usually. I mean, I might extend into William. But I generally am not writing what I would call the real Regency. Sometimes I do, but, you know, I'm within that general period. So as I say, it depends how purist you are. The other thing too is that Highlander's Lost Lady is actually set, don't ask me, 1821? 1821?
No, it is in the Regency, I'm pretty sure.
It absolutely is within the Regency era, and it's not a standard Highland romance, which, you know, as you would read, is sort of medieval and claymores and things like that. It is a Regency, it just happens to be set in the Highlands. However, I was being cunning. I was trying to get that huge Scottish reading population to pick it up as well. So, you know, I was trying to spread my bets. I've got to say, Highlander romance is enormously popular. I did a signing in Slovenia. Do you know that Highlander romance is the most popular genre in Slovenia? How they do that, I don't know, but that's the truth.
Okay, and Alison, are you in the same camp, or are you a purist?
I am a purist. Yes, so definitely the 1811 to 1820 for me. The Lady Helen books are set actually in 1812, and they follow the social seasons. So we first start in London, then Brighton, and then Bath, and just within that year. So I'm very, 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 very clear in that.
Okay. Yep, and I'm pretty much all of my books are set in during the Regency. I did one set in the Peace of Amiens because I wanted them to go on the great grand tour, and until Napoleon was out of the way and until the French Revolution finished, they couldn't. So there was a short period where they were able to do the grand tour, so that was one. I have slid elsewhere occasionally. I did a book which was during the Regency period, and it started in England and it ended in England, but in the meantime they went to Regency era Egypt.
So, okay.
Yeah. So
but
generally
yes.
Purist about
purist,
the dates. Yeah.
The dates.
Yeah.
Okay. But is it just the dates? That's my next question. Or are there some tropes? Are there some things that have to be in them? For example, they've been called novels of manners, haven't they? They seem to always have the class distinctions, the coy virginal girls, the wealthy skin-tight jacketed suitors, sardonic glances, marriage's convenience, words like nonpareil, rake, jilt, on dit. Do you think those have to be in it?
I don't subscribe to any rules about, you know, what has to be in it. A lot of my books have some of those things. I would take issue with the coy heroine. I think mostly my heroines are fairly brave in what they do. They don't sort of sit around blushing. Or they might blush, but that's not all they do. And, look, I grew up with Georgia Tyre, and none of her heroines were sort of coy, shy, silly girls. They were women of action, and what I know about my own family history, the women of my family, particularly my mum's family, they were doing amazing things. And I just think women have always done amazing things. But there are some, you're right about the trope things, some of those things are what readers will look for.
Yes.
in a book called A Regency, and if they don't have it, they're a little bit worried sometimes. But you don't need to have all of them. It's like most things. There's a set of rules, and then you dance around them, or I do.
Well, I think that the tropes, there's more about what are you supplying that gives delight, and some of those tropes give great delight. And so the banter is one of the kind of tropes of Regency fiction, which does give a great deal of delight, and I love writing it as well. And some of the tropes are perhaps now a little bit worn out.
Mm-hmm.
Like the coy,
overused.
Yeah, like the coy heroine, and especially doesn't fit in what I call Jane Austen meets Buffy in her demon slaying mode. So you know, you don't have a coy heroine, but yeah, I think that in terms of what you when you step into the contract between reader and author, there are a set of conventions that...
Expectations.
Yeah, expectations and conventions. And some of the most delightful can just as much give as much delight if they're subverted. But if they are subverted, they need to give as much delight again. because if you don't supply that delight, what you're doing is giving a sense of letdown, which of course none of us want to read.
I also think a lot of those tropes that were listed there are for what I would call a trad Regency. There's actually two versions. There's two sorts of books within the Regency. There's Regency historical, which is what I write, which is that more full-blooded thing. And the trad Regency is what I would call the comedy of manners.
Traditional
Regency. And there used to be a huge, huge market for these. The mainstream publishers stepped aside for them because it was all sort of sex and steam, and there's not a lot of there's a lot of sexual tension. I actually love trad Regencies because the banter is sexual tension through the dialogue, and they're really fun. But what's actually happened with the ebook revolution is that there is a market for these books. There are people who still buy them, and now you can actually buy trad Regencies again, which I'm so happy about. But they're not what I write. I write what you would call a Regency historical, which is tends to be a longer story, considerably more sexual content, considerably more, you know, stuff on the page than you get in a trad Regency. But I so agree about, you know, readers pick up these books because they want to be delighted. You know, it's kind of like, so, you know, you kind of have a Regency reader if you say it's a marriage of convenience story. That's one that just never gets old. So.
And cross-dressing. Never gets old for me.
Oh, do tell us more.
The whole purpose of some of these things that you were listing as tropes, they are to evoke an era.
Yes.
And that helps that sort of cultural sort of placement in time.
Yeah. And what's interesting sometimes is that some of the tropes have historical tags attached to them that are actually wrong.
Yeah,
I can't remember the term of it, but it's so what the received information about the history is incorrect, but if you go against that received history, then you are perceived as being incorrect.
Mm.
So
mm.
It's quite a fine line to walk.
We're kind of talking particularly about the American market in that
sense,
aren't we?
Yeah.
So on the coy virginal, then, seeing as that is interesting, I've noticed that when I read Georgette Heyer and Jane Austen, it just ended with a chaste kiss. Whereas your books often go beyond the chaste kiss.
That's right.
Is this for historical reasons? Have you discovered that, in fact, Regency women weren't as chaste as we have received?
Well,
or is it a response to modern readers' expectations?
I actually think that the... You know, the early thing where you said they always close the door. Most books close the door, you know, on sex, you know, certainly in Jane Austen's time and also in Georgette Heyer's time. But we know from the history that, you know, there were very, very famous families who were believed to have different fathers for just about every kid. Anyone who's done any genealogy has learned that they've discovered that certain ancestors certainly got married right before the birth of the first child or whatever. And I mean, we're all here to prove that the Regency, yeah, they were rooting in the Regency.
There's a very famous aristocratic woman who had 10 children, mainly by different fathers.
Yeah.
What was it, the Harlequin?
No, the Oxford Miscellany.
No, that's another one.
Wasn't it the
Harlequin progeny or something like that. But there were some royal in there as well as...
Yeah, and I mean, there were all those... During the Regency, there were all those royal princes who had their wives, which were not recognised, and mistresses, and they were producing children all over the place. So this whole idea that everybody in the Regency was sort of terribly pure and chaste and well-behaved, that was... the surface, that was the image that everyone was projecting. But in my books, I don't... I actually have a lot of convenient marriage things because my market wants a certain degree of explicit sex, and so I can't come at the Regency girls who are unmarried, who are happily bonking, without any fear of repercussions.
No.
So I just marry the poor little things off.
It was the Harlequin Miscellany. That's
okay.
What they were
it
called.
Was a Harlequin Miscellany.
Miscellany. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah. Sorry, that wasn't
the, but there was an Oxford one as well too, where she notoriously it was, you know, a different father for each of the
yeah. There was no way
did you,
of proving it.
Did you have anything to add to that, Anna?
Well, I agree. I think I love they rooted in the Regency. I want that on a T-shirt.
Someone needs to put that on Twitter.
I think that needs to be on a T-shirt, actually. Yes, because I think that's what people did. But I think one of the things that I loved about reading Alison's book was she made it how incredibly difficult it is for a debutante to actually break out and do anything particularly naughty because you were so under observation. And sometimes it's really difficult. And I don't know if you guys have read a lot of my Christmas stories. The structure of my Christmas stories is often the love scenes and the epilogue after they've got married. Generally in Regency books they get married. That's kind of the end of it. I mean, you know, because that's the era. Because, you know, they're at family house parties. There is no way I could believe in a Regency heroine at a family house party under the sort of observation she would be that she'd be jumping. It just wouldn't happen. And if she did, she'd be disgraced and it just wouldn't be worth it. Mm. So there are ways and means of working around it, but I think for believability you do have to work around it. I don't particularly like the ones where, you know, they don't care if they get pregnant and, you know,
I'll use you
for sex and I don't want to get married, I'm independent, I'm going. That's not how people thought in the Regency. Okay. Yeah.
So, Alison, you did stick very much to the conventions and dragged the romance out over three books. So how did you use the manners to heighten that sexual tension?
When I thought about writing Lady Helen, I wanted some of her obstacles to be from the historical era. So one of the main ones being that a young woman was hardly ever alone. She was always either chaperoned or she had a maid with her or she was under observation. And so to heighten that, she has supernatural abilities that are blossoming and she finds out that she does have a duty to fight demons. So to actually not only slide away from chaperonage to fight demons, you know, to actually just go and do the shops by yourself would be hard enough, but to fight demons is quite difficult. That enclosure, the physical enclosure, also mimics her internal enclosure because she has been taught that she doesn't run. That's unladylike. She doesn't even fling her arms out wide because everything is enclosed, everything is close. And so even just learning how to move her body in a warrior manner is something that she has to break through her own limitations. So it's not only external, but it's internal as well. That kind of sense of she's observing herself and controlling herself. So that was one of the main obstacles that I used.
Yeah. So I've been reading a little bit about the women's historical novel in general, and Diana Wallace has written a fabulous book called The Women's Historical Novel, and she has almost a whole chapter on Georgette Heyer. And she talks about when they were written and why they were written. And she argues that her Regency novels with their Byronic heroes and debutante heroines a lot of the time acted as a fantasy space in which post-war women could escape from the impossibility of romance in an age of Freud, birth control clinics, sex manuals, and a chronic man shortage brought about by the carnage of war. Yet, we are still fascinated by the Regency. Why do you think that is so? What role does a Regency novel play in the age of Tinder?
Well, I think you kind of answered the question with that, actually. I think it's an escape. I mean, I think it's pure entertainment. It's an escape. You know what you're getting. I also think people. I credit the fact that I've got a career to both Jane Austen and Georgette Heyer because I think people want to go back into that world. For a lot of people too, it's books you read when you were younger, and it's still got that love. Because my mother gave me Powder and Patch when I was eight. Which actually isn't a particularly good Georgia hire, I have to say. Mm. But it kind of got me on the run, and so it's also going back to that sort of comfort of childhood thing. So I think there's a lot of, and you know, look at the world today. Wouldn't you rather read a Regency?
I think there's also an element, and I've actually tried to use it in the Dark Days Club, where we have this overlay of civility, and beneath that is all this seething Georgian rowdiness that is being suppressed. So I think that's rather nice to have that kind of that controlled kind of life. That, as you know, that where you think, well, okay, just underneath that is all that simmering hotness, and that dichotomy is very attractive, as to actually say when is it gonna blow?
It's like a volcano.
Yeah, when is it gonna blow? Yeah, and you know, in the modern Regency romances, it blows into sex often, which is very satisfying. But in Lady Helen, there's violence and there's kind of supernatural powers exploding and things like that. So yeah, there's this nice dichotomy going on that really is very attractive.
So it was almost like you had a double fantasy space, because you had this Regency setting and then added another element.
Yes, yeah.
So how important was it to make the Regency incredibly real so that readers could suspend and believe in the other?
For me, it was very, very, very important to ground the reader in historical accuracy. So this is as historically accurate as I could get. And you know, you've heard of many people doing their research, and I'm very much reading for 8 months before I even started, and then visiting England to get that kind of research solid. And so by doing that world, which is physical and visceral, I can segue into the physical and visceral fantasy elements, because they are very fantastical. They are very much rooted in physical phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I think there's two things at work here. One is that, in general, Regency romances are fun with humour, warmth, and a glamorous kind of life. It's not the real Regency. I mean, in the real Regency, yes, of course, there were people who lived like that, but there were people who were, who lived life at war, who were rotting in gutters, drinking gin. There was all sorts of dreadful things. We don't tend to write about those because we're writing feel-good fiction that give people hope. So that's one thing. But I also think the humour is really important.
Yes.
I have a theory that the only subgenre in historical romance that has humour as well is the Regency romance, and that's because Jane Austen wrote with enormous humour and verve, and so did Georgette Heyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the only historical period that is associated with humour, so
yes,
that's feel good as well. But the other thing is, I think we have to look at the video and film versions of Jane Austen. And I think that Colin Firth emerging from a slime-ridden pond in a wet T-shirt had a lot to do with reaching a modern audience, and people deciding, this is fun, this is cool, I want to read that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And I also think with the Regency, which is true about a lot of historical romances in general, the stakes are high. If you marry someone, a marriage of convenience in a contemporary book is actually quite hard to bring off, because the thing is divorce, whereas in a Regency, if you marry this guy, you are stuck with this guy pretty well till the day you die, or he dies, you might kill him.
It's another genre.
Regency noir.
That's what she writes.
So the stakes are higher things. The stakes for things like, You know, we've all read the book. I've written a whole stack of them where, you know, the heroine gets caught in a compromising position with the hero, and marriage is the only thing that will save her reputation, because without a reputation, she is completely flung upon the you know, winds of fortune. Her family disowns her, all the rest and stuff. There's a resonance with that that I think a lot of read... I know I like. I like the fact that, you know, when my heroine decides she's going to sleep with the hero... there's actually really high stakes at play there, you know. So
it's not just swipe to the right, swipe to the left.
Okay, so your research. We're going to open up to questions in a minute, but obviously you all know this era intimately. How? What have your favourite research resources been? On the ground experiences, societies, index cards. I think Georgette Heyer was supposed to have had index cards, over 1,000 historical reference works. So, yeah, I'm sure people would like...
And big folders of notes.
Yes, yes.
I've seen them. If you're interested in Georgette Heyer, Jennifer Kloster wrote the official biography of it, and I've seen some of these things at her place. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you go about it?
Well, for a start, I think I've got my headset in that era, because I grew up with... I've been reading and rereading Georgette Heyer since I was 11. Mm. And when I was trying to work out sort of what I would write in the romance era, and I saw that there was Regency Girls on a cover of a book, I thought, right, that's me. I can do that. But I've got... stacks of research books, and I refer to them depending on what the story is and what I need. Some stories need less research because it's just the manners and the, you know, it's just a personal story. When I've had to bring in, you know, battles or going to other places, the one I set in Egypt. I found some fantastic diaries and letters from English travellers, British travellers in that time. My second book, Tully's Night, I used a collection of letters by a young Irish woman travelling with Lord and Lady Mount Cashel, who actually went to the continent during the Peace of Amiens, and then got caught when Napoleon invaded Piedmonte, and then they had to flee to what is now Denmark. And so those letters and things, and they're so available. I had to buy a book. Well, actually, that particular book, I had to go into the State Library in Melbourne and read it there because it's a valuable, rare book. But then I found it much later when the internet sort of kicked off more. I found a copy in Ireland and bought it. But these days there are so many resources on the web. Yeah. So particularly Australians, where we can't walk the walk every time. No. It's fantastic.
Now, I'm just going to skip over to Anna, because yours are also always set in the Regency, however we define that. So what are your favourite?
It's interesting. Like Anne, you actually develop quite a strong familiarity. You know, so it's not like you don't reinvent the wheel every time you write a book. But what's really interesting is, also like Anne, there's some books you need to do more research for than others. Often if I'm doing something that's very heavy research-wise, I'll read, and then there'll be the one book. There will be the one book that gives you exactly what you want. And a couple of examples of that was my fourth book, Captive of Sin. The hero was a spy for the East India Company. Now, it's not actually part of the actual story. It's his backstory. But I needed to know it, and I needed to know it fairly well. And I read all that. And the thing about the East India Company is there wasn't terribly much about the Regency, which surprised me, because I thought there would be, because that's, you know, it's quite an important thing in the history, because, you know, Wellington, it could have been the French who took over India. You know, it was one of those, you know, close things. It's like Australia could have been settled by the French, because the French sailed in 6 days after the First Fleet. There was a book I found called The White Mughals by William Dalrymple. Yeah. And it's actually a tragic story about a love affair between a Muslim princess and a factor of the East India Company, and it had everything I needed. It was funny, you know, it was kind of like, oh, at last I found it. Second book was about madness in the Regency, and I read all sorts of stuff. I struggled through as a Derrida, did something about, you know, madness, and it's not really madness, it's all society, none of which was any use to me. But there was a book by Roy Porter called Man-Made Shackles or Man-Shackled Mind or something. It's a quote from Hamlet. And that gave me exactly what, you know, mental treatment of mental illness in the Regency was. So it was funny. If I needed something in depth, you know, somewhere the fates would actually present me with the actual, you know, I'd read all around and go, I'm not finding it, and then you'd find the one book you actually needed. So Mind Shackled Manacles. It's a Hamlet quote. Is that the quote? It's in the to be or not to be speech anyway, so yeah.
Now, Alison, you haven't only set books in the Regency, so it's a different research process. So how have you got yourself from Imperial China into the Regency?
I seem to have come very late to Hare because I was only given my first book when I was 13. So again, I have read a lot of Hare and Jane Austen, and I lived through the phenomenon that which was the 1995 television series, when it was that everyone was having every week we were glued to our television, having Pride and Prejudice parties and things like that. So when I decided to write the Lady Helen books, I'd just come from Jen Closter's workshop at the RWA, and I'd always thought I didn't have enough research ability to do the Regency, because there are websites set up to say this book got this wrong in the Regency. It's quite a high bar.
Although some of those are wrong.
Yeah. Yes. And so I was feeling a little bit intimidated, but Jen reassured me, because this was when I first met Jen and we became friends, and she said, no, there's so many resources now and there are so many ways that you can find these things out. So that started my eight-month reading journey, which was full-time, 8 months of immersing myself into the Regency. Firstly, this is the first book and it's set in the London season, so I was researching the London season. This one is the Brighton season, the summer season, and then this one is Bath. And so I did research for each of the seasons, each of the cities, went to each of the cities, to the point where I, in order to be able to have Lady Helen do her shopping in Bath, I went to the newspapers of the time, the 1812 December newspapers, and built a map of the shops from the advertisements. So that when she went into a particular shop, she was going into the right shop. That's because I am a complete nerd and I enjoy doing it. But I do like that kind of anchoring in the real. Because I am stepping into the supernatural, I love that anchoring into the real. So there was a lot of reading, there was a lot of walking the ground, which is just a joy, and which is what my PhD is on, actually. And within that, I get to this point, and you have to wait for that point when you know that when you reach for something in your writing room, you know that there's a six-hour candle that will be in the ballroom. You know that when they walk into a room, there will be a certain type of carpet. So there's this level of seepage
detail.
Yeah, of seepage detail that you know that world is just sitting there, and that when you reach for that information, it'll be there. And of course, the process as you go along is you always have to reach for more information. It's never like, oh, that's it. It's always to be researched, always to be double-checked, triple-checked. But I get to that point, I need to get to that point where it is there, this base level.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to open up to questions if we have any. Do we want to grab our... I think this... Oh, and then there's a gentleman at the back. Yeah.
You've talked about the kind of physical and societal consequences of pregnancy. What about religion and the effect of religion on your characters?
Generally, I have people going to church, like, you know, Sunday morning, it's an obligation, they go to church and stuff. I think for modern readers, I don't really push it. Religion was still playing a huge part in
English life or Scottish life too. Well, as I say, Canna, three churches, 17 people at that stage. But I think that's one of the things that I tend to play down. But, you know, people went to church on Sunday mornings, you know, so I often do have... And sometimes you can use that as an opportunity for things, you know. Mm. So you know, it's a chance to, you know, they gossip. Her Christmas Earl, she's caught with the Earl. They get locked in a cupboard and she's caught with the Earl, and so it's a hurried marriage. And she has to face going to church Christmas morning with everybody having seen her come out of this cupboard with the Earl. And it sort of just underlines quite how horrible all this is for her. So you can use it, but I do have people praying in my thing, you know, so, you know, oh, I pray she'll be all right, that sort of thing. So I kind of gloss over it, so I don't...
Well, to me it was quite important because Lady Helen is a religious girl. She's been brought up in the Anglican faith. And when she starts to exhibit these powers, she starts to question whether or not she's unnatural or whether she's actually coming from the devil rather than God. So she has this tussle of what is going on here and where does it fit within her religion. For me it was quite important, and she does come to some kind of resolution with that, but it takes some kind of philosophical thinking in that sense, that she has to come to say, well, actually, where does this ability, is it God-given or is it devil-given? It does play a part.
Mm. And for me it depends on the story and the characters. Like Anna, I pretty much have it in the background. People go to church on Sundays, not everybody. And they don't travel on Sundays and some of those kind of things. And Christmas was different, you know, not the Victorian style Christmas and trees, all of that sort of stuff. But it depends. And some characters, you know, might be more religious. I don't really... My stories are not really about their beliefs. So it's a background in the same way that other things are... background, giving texture to the story, but it's not what the story's about, so I don't concentrate on it.
Mm.
And I'm not religious, so, you know, I don't feel the need to underline things.
Actually, the piece that I'm working on now is about an apostate within the Regency and how that plays out. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting one.
And I did have a character who was taken to China by her stepfather, who was a minister and out there to be a missionary.
Mm.
So, you know, as I said, it's with whatever the particular story's about.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.